Well, as always, it's lovely to be up here in Vancouver. Lotus Land, as it's called. I'd like to read you something that I wrote the other day. Oh Lord, your realization comes but from thy will. If I were a clever thief, I might trick you into giving me realization. As a great artist, I would do some work of art and charge enlightenment as my commission. A magnificent intelligence might talk you into revealing yourself. If a mighty warrior, I could earn your grace. As a jokester, I would make you laugh and thereby receive your holy vibration. But my Lord, you did not create me with any such gifts. You did but put a desire deep in my soul to know you in the most intimate way. Therefore, I stand before you as one without whim, thought, or fancy, other than to be one with you. I have nothing to give but that which I have falsely thought of as mine. I, even this false sense of I, do I offer all that I have thought of as my own, and I surrender it at your feet. It is not greatness I give, but it is rather common and clay-like. It has no great merit to recommend itself, but it is all I have known. And I lay it at your feet with all my heart, mind, and soul. I pray that you find such an unworthy gift as what I have called my life as acceptable, not because it is worthy, rather because it is all that I may claim as my own. Please accept it, my dear one, and make me know you through and through, until there is no more me and you, but only your existence, your divine wisdom, your ever new bliss, only you. From the Bhagavad Gita, or the Song Celestial, the Bible of India. The world is overcome, I even here, by such as fix their faith on unity. The sinless Brahma dwells in unity, and they in Brahma. Be not over glad, attaining joy. Be not over sad, encountering grief. But stayed on Brahma, still constant let each abide. The sage whose soul holds off from outer contacts, in himself finds bliss, to Brahma joined by piety. His spirit tastes eternal peace. The joys springing from sense life are but quickening wounds, which breed sure griefs. Those joys begin and end. The wise mind takes no pleasure, Kunti-san, in such as those. But if a man shall learn, even while he lives and bears his body chain, to master lust and anger, he is blessed. He is the yukta. He hath happiness, contentment, light within. His life is merged in Brahma's life. He doth nirvana touch. Thus go the rishis unto rest, who dwell with sins effaced, with doubts at end, with hearts governed and calm. Glad in all good they live, nigh to the peace of God. And all those live who pass their days exempt from greed and wrath, subduing self and senses, knowing the soul. The saint who shuts outside his placid soul, all touch of sense, letting no contact through, whose quiet eyes gaze straight from fixed brows, whose outward breath and inward breath are drawn equal and slow through nostrils still and close. That one, with organs, heart, and mind constrained, bent on deliverance, having put away passion and fear and rage, hath even now obtained deliverance, ever and ever freed. Yea, for he knows me, who am he that heeds the sacrifice and worship, God revealed. And he who heeds not, being Lord of worlds, lover of all that lives, God unrevealed, wherein who will shall find surety and shield. I would like to speak this evening on the householder's sadhana. In India, the word sadhana denotes the path or the discipline in order to attain spiritual consciousness. The focus of our attention and the intent of our lives comes into clear focus when we enter into the spiritual path. The spiritual path is different from those who lead a life strictly for the world. The spiritual lies inherently within each and every individual, and yet is apart from it. It is the consciousness that has gone into making all of creation, and this creation has come from that one same consciousness, even as each of us as individuals have been spun, so to speak, from that great loom, of God's infinite mind. Because we have come from that source, that mind of God, each and every one of us share in that. Jesus says that it is our inheritance, that we have the kingdom of heaven within. Now, it is clearly expressed in the New Testament that the kingdom of heaven is within you. And yet that is greatly overlooked. So many people think of living this life and then at some later point discovering that the kingdom of heaven lies sometimes after death. We think of heaven as being someplace far, someplace distant, some remote part of the cosmos perhaps, or someplace above and beyond where we are at in this moment. But if the kingdom of heaven is within you, then where else can it be but here and now? If God is omnipresent, equally present everywhere in this universe, then where is he not? If he is omnipotent and is the only source of power within all these universes, then whose power do we exist by except that same power? And if he is omniscient, or he is the only consciousness that has gone into creating these vast and wonderful worlds that we see around us, this body that we inhabit, and all the rest of it, then what other consciousness is there? There can only be one. And it is our mind that deceives us into seeing two, or many, many more than that. But the reality is that when you are lifted up in consciousness, you feel yourself one with all creation, and there is no separation. This little bubble of the self dissolves, and when it dissolves, the consciousness is released from body consciousness, and it expands into infinite consciousness. Now, this is quite an assertion. You might well ask yourself, why is this not experienced more often if this is true, if this is inherent? The answer is because our attachment for this body and the things of the senses runs very deep in us. It's not just a conscious decision that we will burst this bubble of the self and release it into the infinite self, but rather we have to work down through all the unconscious programming that's gone into making this our soul focus of attention, being here on this earth, being in this body, looking out through these five senses. But when we withdraw the mind and the focus of attention from the five senses, it automatically comes back into the spine. And when it comes back into the spine, it gradually begins to make its way back up the spine. This is why we're taught in meditation to keep our focus here at the third eye point, or the Ajna Center. This is the doorway towards your own infinite consciousness. Within the spine are located five different centers, and these centers are plexus, or chakra means wheel. And when you are lifted up into inner consciousness, you can actually see these different wheels of light, or these different energy centers residing within the spine. And they have beautiful, lustrous color. and each one corresponds with particular inner sounds that you hear. Now, these are not sounds that somebody who may also be in the room may hear also if they're not attuned to it, but rather it's heard with the inner ear. So that we hear sometimes the high-pitched sound of a flute that comes in. Other times it's the drone of the bumblebee. And other times it's the ringing of a bell, and so on. But these sounds come to the inner ear, and each one represents a separate experience within the spinal centers. But the reason for keeping the concentration here at the third eye point is because this represents the doorway or the portal into your own heavenly consciousness. As long as we keep the mind focused on the senses and on this body and our identification is with this body, there we relegate ourselves. Not because anyone has forced us to do so, but because we of our own free will have chosen to do so. But when we enter into the spiritual path, we resolve to go beyond just knowing this body, this world of the senses, and we want to enter into realm spiritual. And so this is a great adventure. Perhaps what starts you out on the spiritual path is some experience, or perhaps a series of experiences, that convinces you to the core of your being that there is something that lies beyond the world of the senses. Perhaps you have become disenchanted with this world and you know intuitively somehow inside yourself that something exists beyond this. Whatever the cause is, we are all joined here this evening because we have resolved somewhere in ourselves that we want to focus our attention in this way. And you may think to yourself, well, I'm a little bit of this and I'm a little bit of that. I like the things of the world, but I also like a little bit of things of the spirit. And so back and forth the mind goes. And so while you're in that state of mind, you perhaps get little touches, little tastes of spiritual experience. But this is a path for the last final mile. And those are those ones who want to go the whole way. They are not just dabblers. They are not just looky-loos, you might say. They are the ones who have really put their focused attention and want to get somewhere, spiritually speaking. In order to do this, we must gain a deep resolve within ourselves. Now, many of us have come from mixed backgrounds. I myself, coming to this path, was not living the life that perhaps I should have been or that you would think of a spiritual person seeking out. Oftentimes, people who gain great resolve in the spiritual path go down many crooked alleyways before they find that pathway within their own spine and brain towards this infinite consciousness. Whatever your past is, that's just it. It's a thing of the past. And you can decide here and now that this becomes a priority for you. Why would we do this? Because right within you lies a great reservoir of spontaneous joy, spontaneous wisdom, spontaneous love, and the power that has gone into creating all these vast universes. And it is yours to know. You exist not just in this physical body, but within this physical body or beyond it also resides the astral body. Now, the astral body is an electrical body, and that is a descriptor of how you might experience it when you get lifted up. You might also call it your dream body, because when you go and let go of physical consciousness and move into your dream world, you are moving within your own astral body. And through that astral body, there are different ways to experience things. You can experience sounds through touch. You can experience feeling through sight. There's all different kinds of ways of knowing things through your astral body. This opens you to new experiences. However, this is just the beginning, really. because beyond the astral body lies the causal body. Now this is the mental body or the thought body. When you exist in this body, you are aware of vast thoughts and wonderful insights and intuitive wisdom that comes to you spontaneously. But even here, there is a veil of separation. There is still the knower and the known. And so duality continues to exist. This journey started by entering into this world of duality. The story of Adam and Eve is really quite a wonderful one. It's been tried to be taken literally, but really it's a wonderful allegory of how we entered into this dual consciousness. Adam, which represents reason, and Eve, which represents feeling, are those parts of our consciousness, in its own purity. And originally, the consciousness was one with God, or in other words, spiritual consciousness was part and parcel of what we experienced in our fullness. But when we entered into this world of duality, that's represented by the serpent. Now, the serpent power is this tremendous kundalini power within your own spine. And the serpent power starts out in the medulla and goes through the medulla and into the brain, and that's where our life force comes from. And then it goes down through the spine and is distributed out through all the nervous system. Now, there is a tree in the midst of the garden, in the Garden of Eden story. And this is the sexual organs within each of us. And when the kundalini power, that serpent power, reaches down into that center, then it tempts us to go out and experience sexual experiences. Now, of course, our bodies are designed in this way, and it's natural in a human sense. But from a spiritual standpoint, it represents the polar opposite of remaining in oneness, in that union with God within our own consciousness. And when the energy is directed down into the sexual centers, then we objectify our complement in another. We look for that complement within another human being, and so we lose that fullness of that one consciousness. And we become enamored with this world. And so that's why that represents this greatest separation. And so the serpent force tempts Adam, which is reason, and Eve, which is feeling. And first it comes through feeling, or the Eve force. And then reason follows. And so oftentimes in our day-to-day life, we might get attracted to another person. And this great feeling overcomes us. And then our reason quickly follows. You know, we can find any excuse imaginable, whatever the circumstances are, in order to try to fulfill that desire. Once again, from a human standpoint, this is a natural thing to happen. But from a spiritual standpoint, it magnetizes the spine down to the base center, the base of the spine. And because of this, we lose the spiritual consciousness. And the result of doing this is that the serpent is relegated to crawl on its belly. Or in other words, as God gave me in meditation one time, the serpent is relegated to the lower parts of the spine, where within our own bellies of our own bodies. And so there it sits, like a coiled up serpent, that is not able to rise from its own ashes, not at least at that point. And so the more incarnations that we spend expending the life force that we are given out through the senses, this is our burnt offerings, and we give the burnt offerings to God. In other words, we have taken this life force that has been freely given to us, we expend it out through all the senses, and then when we're in trouble, we ask God for some help. We search out for that oneness of consciousness. But we have spent it all, so we are offering nothing but burnt offerings at that point. So in order to reverse this process, We must go within ourselves and start to raise that consciousness. Now, it's very interesting in the Garden of Eden that the first impact on Adam and Eve is that they hide from God. Or in other words, the separation overcomes the consciousness. And what are the first feelings that they have? Those of fear and of shame. Now, fear comes as a natural result of biting into the fruit of the tree of good and bad, the knowledge of good and evil. That's what the tree that they bit into. And this is entering into duality. This is this tree of good and evil. And so in order to reverse this process, it comes about through first intentional acts of will. In the beginning, we start our meditation with concentration. And we focus here at the third eye point. And we use the breath, because the breath is the connection between soul and spirit. In Greek, spirit means breath, or to breathe. And so this is universal knowledge wherever you go around the world. There's this focus of attention on the breath. Breath signifies the solidification of body consciousness. When the baby comes out, its air passage is cleared, and there's perhaps a slap on the back, and the breath starts. And that soul is then identified with the physical body. And from there on, all of its attention comes into operating this physical body. At the time of our leaving, the breath stops. The eyes roll up typically towards the third eye point, and the soul makes a conscious or unconscious exit out of the body. Now, yogis have developed themselves to the point where they can make this conscious exit. Perhaps they have foreknowledge of when it is that they are going to leave the body. And for them, it is like discarding an old overcoat. Nothing more. Because they have come to realize that their life is not the body. And so this is the basic assumption that we make on a very deep unconscious level. So one of the first consequences of entering into dual consciousness is fear. And the fear is that one day we will die, one day we will disappear. We are vulnerable within these human bodies. We feel ourselves but temporary residents. And perhaps we come up with the idea that when this body ceases to be, we cease to be. And so there is a deep unconscious fear that is associated with that. The other is shame. They were ashamed in order to see God. And this seems to be something that is deeply embedded within us all. Mother Hamilton, my own teacher, used to say that this idea of sin was perpetrated on an unsuspecting public or unsuspecting humanity, and that it is one of the greatest misdeeds that have ever been done. We should be living life wisely, but this has nothing to do with the kind of shame, the kind of indoctrination into sin that we have gotten, most of us, from our births. There is but one sin, if you want to say it that way. And that is the idea of separation from your oneness with God. And every other mental and behavioral error comes from that. Now, in order to know God isn't to become something or somebody else. Somebody used to say to me, you know, it's like, do you have to be like the church lady? You know, in a television comedy show where this very persnickety, disapproving, looking down on the rest of the world and just seeing sin, sin, sin everywhere. Do you need to be that? That's not being a spiritual person. Being a spiritual person means that your heart becomes more softened. You become more loving. You experience more spontaneous joy within your own being. You see the world as a manifestation of divine consciousness, and so that every person who comes before you is a manifestation of that divine. And whether they realize it or not, you see that in them. and by seeing them as a manifestation of the divine consciousness, you hold them in the greatest light. Now, if you want individuals around you to change, don't see them in the lowest light. So oftentimes we get focused on what's wrong with another person. We think we know better. We think we know what's right for them. And the truth is that too often it's a result of the discomfort that we feel in their presence. And so we want them to modify their behavior so that we're somewhat more comfortable. We're more at ease. And it has nothing to do with what is good for their highest good, but it is rather for our own ease that we would like them to change. Now, anger comes about as attachment. When we're attached to seeing the world and people around us in a particular way, we grow rigid in that view. And if they vary outside of that notion that we have, then we experience frustration because of the difference between how they're behaving and how we think they ought to behave, or how circumstances are around us and how we think they ought to be. That attachment causes us untold misery. And so we need to get to the roots of it, which is our attachment of how we think things ought to be. And if we could but let go of that, it doesn't mean that you cease to think. It doesn't mean that you cease to hold opinions or have some ideals in your mind. But you let go of the attachment to it. And when you go to the roots of that tree and chop it out with an axe of wisdom and topple it, and you let go of your attachment to how you think people and situations should be, you would find that you can experience untold joy even in this moment. That the kingdom of heaven is all about you, and it is here now. There is no other place to go. You always think, well, if my life were just different, if I had more money, if I had somebody in my life who I could love just so, if I could have just the right children, if I could just have the most beautiful home or the right amount of money or whatever the circumstances are, it goes on and on and on. And you think, then I would be happy. But look at those individuals whom you have known, perhaps, who have had that amount of money, that have had that beautiful home, that it had some notoriety or some fame. Does that cause happiness for them? It's very interesting because they did a poll on people who won lottery tickets. Millions of dollars suddenly come into their lives. And you would think that they would be the happiest people on the earth. Well, what they discovered was that people who were, before the lottery was won, were generally happy, well-adjusted, okay with their lives. After the lottery winnings, they were generally happy, well-adjusted with their lives. People who were unhappy, miserable in their lives, after the lottery winning, miserable, unhappy with their lives. It made no difference. No difference at all. And yet, we always think that that will make the difference for us. The truth is that joy is part of your nature. That the world of the senses will give you some pleasure, but for every pleasure, there is pain. For every good thing, there is something that is negative that happens. And that you always look at somebody else's life and you go, look, they're laughing and they're joyful and they must have some really good things. And perhaps they do. Perhaps they do. But maybe people look at your life and they think the same thing about you. And yet inside you know that you're not totally happy. You're not totally joyful. You don't experience that bliss, that interior wisdom. Those are things that are part of your inheritance, and it has nothing to do with your station in life. It has nothing to do with how much money or how many friends or who you have in your life. What it has everything to do with is where you place your attention. There's a saying that I think is wonderful, that attitude determines altitude. And this is very true, I think. Now, there may be circumstances that are pretty tough to overcome. But there's so much in life for us to look around, and we could complain. We could complain about a million things. Oh, I have some aches in my body today. Or, oh, somebody treated me rudely at the store today. Or, you know, I really need to have more money, and so on and so on. Or we could look around our lives. We could be walking down the sidewalk. Notice that the birds are singing. Just notice the trees around us. That we could feel a certain flush of love just come through us. We feel that as a spontaneous notion that comes through us. You know, recently, God has just been filling me up so much. I've been experiencing so much bliss and so much joy that it's difficult to even allow it to fully run through the body. And it even makes it a little difficult to operate in this world because of that. Now, we're told ultimately that with Sahaja Samadhi, or natural state Samadhi, you can operate totally normally in this world and yet retain that joy and that bliss within you. But until we reach that point, we're still in that state, perhaps, of Nirvikalpa Samadhi. Now, Nirvikalpa Samadhi, you're able to move and to breathe and have that joy within your being. But there is still some residue of ego, so there is still a moving in and out somewhat. Before that state comes Sabbakalpa Samadhi. And that is the upliftment within the consciousness, and your body falls as if dead. There's a wonderful devotee who's been going through some spiritual experiences. And so they were at my house, and I played for them a tape of the chant of Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And when the tape started, they just fell flat on their face as if they'd been taken swoon, and they just were totally out of their body consciousness. And so this is the way it is in this Sabbakalpa Samadhi. You just, it's as if your breath is taken away. Now there's nothing to fear in this, because your breathing will continue in as much as it's necessary, and perhaps it'll stop altogether, but that's all right. When you're in that state, you're in a perfect state of safety. But all of your life force is drawn up from the base of your spine. It goes up to the medulla, this is the sixth center here, and shoots straight across to your third eye point. And you can track it within your own body. You can feel it move straight up through your spine and come to this point. And when it comes to that point, and it's working its way through that center, it feels like a great deal of pressure here. And it feels like it's pushing through. It's trying to push through something. And it can be quite painful at times. But when that evolutionary energy moves up through the spine and comes to that point and then moves through it, it opens that doorway. And when that happens, you enter into your own spiritual kingdom. Now, still at the sixth point, there is still a sense of duality. There's still a sense of me and mine. There's still a sense of the devotee and God. And there's that thin veil of separation. But when you move through that, then you come into the top, or the crown center at the top of your head. And there you feel a tremendous expansion. And that is total oneness with the infinite mind. And when you have completed the circuit and gone totally to that level of consciousness, then most often souls drop the body because all use for the body is gone at that time. But there is a choice at that point. Mother talked about being lifted up in consciousness in that way, and she was just in the bliss and the oneness with God. And she knew that there is a choice. She could leave the body at that moment, or she could come back into the body and serve all humanity from there. And for her, she said there was no question of a doubt, but that she looked and thought about the world and the suffering that occurs in the world, mostly because people are lacking in spiritual consciousness. And so her heart just automatically went out to the world. And so gradually she came back down into body consciousness. But she had to fight her way back down because this terrific consciousness kept on calling her and trying to bring her up and out and away. And she had to fight, and she did it by doing actually kind of worldly things. She would go to see funny movies. She would do things that were more worldly in order to try to bring herself back down into physical consciousness again. But the difference is that there is no attachment to anything in the physical. You experience the body, you experience this world, but your consciousness is always linked with that infinite consciousness. And because of that, you are an ever-freed being, and you are free to operate just as God instructs you to, moment by moment. And so this is the greatest step in human evolution, and it takes you beyond the human to the divine. And this is the focus of our attention. This is why we have come here, and it is the final mile. And if you were but to take your courage in hand and decide deep within yourself that this is for you, then you might have these experiences and you might know the mind of God, the being of God, the experience of God. And it is not that you become all of God, because God is infinite, but consciously you become one with that. There is no longer that veil of separation. And then you become an instrument for that divine consciousness. And for you, there is nothing but that spirit of joy, that spirit of love, that spirit of bliss and wisdom. You become that. You don't just experience it. You become that. And what greater thing could there be in this entire world and this entire universe, or universes beyond, than to have that consciousness? So I'd like to stop here and see, for those who are practicing and those who are perhaps new, if there's any questions that come that you would like to ask. And just to remind you that if the question is in your mind, you can bet that it's in others' minds. And so there's no question not to be asked.
Did you mean, David, that universe is beyond?
Well, this is but one manifestation. This material universe, and not only that, but we are told by Sri Yukteswar that there are universes beyond this. And beyond all the physical manifestations, there are these great astral universes, these beautiful luminous worlds. And when you develop spiritually, you can have experiences in those worlds. But they can, in and of themselves, become tempting because they are beautiful beyond comparison, and so we can be drawn towards those. But in order to do that, we take our minds away from that infinite consciousness. So there are many levels of consciousness to experience. Jesus said, in my Father's mansion, there are many rooms, I believe. I don't know if that's quite the right quote, but it's the idea. There are lots of levels of consciousness that we can explore. But we are told to seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, and all these other things will be added unto you. So go first to that absolute consciousness, and then you're freed to explore all the other levels of manifestations. You do it in perfect oneness and safety and unity, and that makes all the difference. You don't get ensnared into those different places. There are many temptations that come along on the spiritual path. When you go inside, there are different even states of bliss and upliftment. They can be very tempting to stay in, but they're not the final realization. They are but temporary stopways as the train moves from intersection to intersection, getting to the final goal. So you might have those experiences, but the idea is not to get off the train yet, because you're not at your final destination. Keep on the move. You also see some beautiful visions that occur here at the third eye point. And you will see some magnificent things there. But there again, even great saints and great sages. It's a remarkable testament, I think, to Swami Ramdas that he had a vision of Krishna. And he asked Krishna to take that vision away of his individual self and give him the universal vision where he saw Krishna in every particle of creation. That's the kind of renunciation that is required in order to get to that final goal. And so we must be quite strict on keeping our minds on the highest. If we deviate from that, then we get pulled into that world and into the laws of that world. And we can get lost in that for a very long time, and that becomes our new alternate reality. In one way, we think that we've advanced because perhaps it's more of a psychic world. But in another way, in a spiritual sense, it's useless. And our attachment draws us into that, and it does us no good at all spiritually. So the thing is to keep our minds attached to the highest. There once was a king who wanted to find a successor. He had no son. So he decided to take all of his top cabinet members and he gave them a test. And he sent out messengers to each one and said, come and see me as quickly as you can get here. Well, along the way, he had arranged all these different fairs and exhibits, all this entertainment, all the different temptations he could possibly think of. And so as the different cabinet members walked along one by one, they got drawn off here and there and the rest of the place. But the prime minister kept straight on and went straight to the castle, straight to the king, and bowed there before his feet. And he says, where are the others? He says, well, each one by one, got tempted off. Why didn't you? I always had my mind that I should come here first. He said, that's very good. Because you have done this, you get the entire kingdom. And so you see, then he had access to the entire kingdom. And whereas the others just got a little piece here and there. And so that's the way we should be in our spiritual quest. What a wonderful story. We get so many wonderful stories. A nice way to teach truth.
I think of it in terms of annihilation. Like I think of my spirit being smashed apart and all the molecules in the universe,
Yeah. Well, the ego sense in us tells us to surrender is to become annihilated or subservient to something else, and then in either way we disappear as individuals or we cease to have our life or our freedom or all those kinds of things. When we surrender spiritually, it's different than surrendering to an outside individual. Spiritual surrender is the surrender of the individualized consciousness to the universal consciousness. The reason this must happen is because it's our identity as an individual that keeps us separate, that keeps us apart from. And as long as we maintain that, then we'll always have some veil of separation between ourselves and that great consciousness from which we were born. When we surrender inwardly to that, we overcome that fear of annihilation. And what happens is that takes us through the experiences necessary that this individual sense of self gets, it does get annihilated. It's talked about in many different ways. In the Christian tradition, it's talked about as the crucifixion. The Son of Man, or the human ego, must go through that crucifixion in order to overcome, so that it's the release of the ghost and it's the return with the Holy Ghost. The ghost is the human self, and that's taken away. But what we get in return is the Holy Ghost, or the spiritualized sense of self. And so it would be, one analogy would be like a small child saying, I don't want to give up being a small child in order to be an adult. When the reality, the adult includes also the small child, but the small child does not include the adult. The spiritual self includes the smaller self. But we have to let go of our soul attention on the individual self in order to grow into the spiritual self. And then if the spiritual self chooses to, it can still express itself through the individualized self, but it's done in a new way, in a different way. And so it's different than doing it to another human being or becoming enslaved to somebody, but it's done with the idea that through that experience, we gain such great spiritual treasure that we never look back and say, oh, I wish that I hadn't done that in some way. But rather, we just thank our lucky stars that something inside of us awakened to that fact. Does that make sense, or?
Well, could you say, like, one good thing about being in your spiritual self?
Uh-huh. Yeah. In a way, it's difficult to describe because it's that without having had the experience, it's you can only project your mind to that. If you had never visited some place in the world, you could read books about it, you could look at the maps and all the rest of it, but would it be difficult to know exactly what that place, what does it smell like, what does it taste like, what does it touch like, all of that. So a way of describing it, though, is that there is an expansiveness that goes beyond this body. You lose the boundaries of just this body, physical body, and your consciousness enters into a spiritual realm where you feel this, number one, this great expansiveness beyond anything that you can imagine at this point. You feel the bliss and the joy that spontaneously is part of that consciousness. And wisdom thoughts come into your mind that are beyond your own knowing, beyond your own reading, that you know for certain inside of yourself because every cell of your being rings out with the truth of it. You don't any longer feel as if you're perhaps, as we all do as human beings, feel kind of lost in this world or not quite at home. All of those kinds of things, those things are completely let go of. And you feel as if you are in your own world, your own kingdom. You have total oneness with it. And so all of that sense of separation no longer exists. And it really feels like you are arriving home, like you are truly knowing who you are. And everything up until then had just been a bit of vague knowing about that. And suddenly, it's like going from black and white to technicolor. And there's with this transformation comes a new life that Jesus says you will have life and have it more abundantly. And yet, going through the death of the little self, of the preoccupation of who we are, who we thought we are, who we've been programmed into thinking we are, has to go in order for us to realize that greater self. So it is the truth of who you are. There is what starts us out on our journey, a faith. We take it on in faith, perhaps because of an intuitive experience, perhaps because we've had some taste of it, that there's something greater for us. But by virtue of the fact that we haven't attained it yet, we can't truly know it until we've experienced it. And then once having experienced it, we know it because we have it, that experience. And that becomes a constant feature in us, that experience. It's not just something you have and then it goes away. In the beginning, that's true. You have touches with it, you have tastes of it, it moves in and out, in and out. But as you gradually gain more and more experience with that, all sense of the individual identity moves away and this greater identity moves in. There's the story of the mongoose and the cobra that's told. And the mongoose attacks the cobra, but the cobra is much quicker. And the cobra will sting and bite the mongoose, and it's poisonous for the mongoose, But the mongoose knows that to go and chew on neem leaves is an antidote for that. And so as soon as it gets stung, it runs and it bites on the neem leaf long enough to get the antidote. And then it runs back and it joins the battle again. And in that way, meditation is the neem leaf for us. And we dive into meditation and we feel that sense of peace, we feel that sense of wholeness, that oneness. And then we move out into the world and the world stings us and bites us. And so we run back to the neem leaf again and we get some more of the antidote. But gradually what happens is that the cobra is overcome and the mongoose wins the day by doing that. And so in the same way, we taste what that is, that peace, that bliss, that joy, those wisdom thoughts, and gradually that becomes more and more consuming. And that you might say is a positive addiction versus the negative addiction of the things of the world. And when we get addicted to that joy, to that peace, to that sense of wholeness, then we experience more and more of that. Our mind draws us to that. It's pretty wonderful. And there's no need for fear around it. That we can trust in that. And we can trust in ourselves that we will be taken to where it is that we should be going. But it's a difficult battle. When we get on the spiritual path, you know, sometimes we think of it, oh, well, it's all just peace and home and, you know, but it's not that way. It's a battlefield. And it's back and forth. The ego rears its ugly head and strikes out and wants to ensnare us again. And we struggle onwards and back and forth we go. And some battles we win and some we lose. The main thing is to stay steady, never to give up, never to give in, just steadily marching onward. And if we go through slips or falls, get up, brush the dirt off, and keep on traveling. And that way we can make sure progress. And it's not a journey for sprinters. It's a journey for long-distance runners. Those ones who can set a pace for themselves and continue on through thick and thin. Sprinters tend to get a start, fast start, but they die out quickly, and then they lose heart.
Is there still the battles with worldly things like bills and survival worries and, you know, having to deal within the world?
The world still exists. And the body still may experience some anxieties and different things here and there. The difference is that they're easily mastered. If there's something that causes some amount of fear or something like that, it may take temporary hold. But self-mastery is being able to put that aside and refocus the attention where it should be. And so All of those things become seen as something that belongs to the body, something that belongs to the lower mind. They may still exist in some vague form, but they don't have that holding power. They don't grab hold of us and drag us down, like perhaps they once did. Even great masters experience some anxieties and some tensions around different things. And that's a natural aspect of living in the world, of assuming a body and being in the body, but they're not ensnared by it. It doesn't draw them into it and encapsulate them in that, and that's the difference. So self-mastery is not having no experience around things of the world or things of the body, but rather it's being able to gain some mastery over it and always keeping the mind attached to the infinite.
Sort of managing the world in a calm way.
Whether it's through a calm way, a centered way, those are different ways of saying it. Yeah. Yeah. You don't get attached to it, you don't get pulled into it in the same way. It'd be like, if you had an itch in your finger and you scratched it, you'd realize that the itch is in your finger, but it doesn't dominate your whole self. You might even ignore it if you chose to, or you might scratch it. You might do anything with it, but your whole mind and consciousness doesn't get pulled into it. And so a master has a body and is aware of the body and what's going on with the body, but it's not the all-consuming thing. Because this consciousness is a presence in you. And this presence when I think of words of how to describe it, I lose descriptive power. But this presence is inside of you, and when you feel it, you know it. There's a certain peace about it. There's a certain joy about it. There's a certain wholeness about it. And so oftentimes people walk around with these big holes inside of them, and they look for all kinds of things to fill up that hole. And nothing will do it. You'll find temporary things, but nothing will give you that constant abiding presence except for that presence. That's the only thing that can really hit the mark. So you have an experience of the body, and yet the experience of that presence is what really dominates your consciousness. So you might have some physical pain. You might have some other kinds of things that draws your mind to it somewhat, but always what's true is that presence, that wonderful gift of presence.
And when that energy is going out, do you find things have a way of coming together? And so therefore there's less worry? You know, the old idea that what we put out into the universe tends to come back. If we're worrying and negative, then it complicates things for us.
Well, what we begin to do is what we see that all experience, whether it is so-called negative or positive, is all a manifestation of divine consciousness. And we can do that right now. You can take every experience that comes to you as for your highest good, whether it appears to be negative or positive. Who can judge in the mind? You know, the mind wants to say, this is good and this is bad. But how many times have you gone through a really difficult experience? But later on, those are the stories that you tell. And maybe everybody laughs and joins in on the fun. But at the time, it didn't feel fun, and it didn't feel very enjoyable. So the mind wants to say, this is good and this is bad. But who knows that those might not make up the best stories for later on. What kind of movies do we want to go see? We don't want to see people just living kind of everyday normal lives usually. We want to see people who are in difficult circumstances but are finding their way through it, overcoming them somehow. Those are the greatest stories of the heroes. And in order to be a hero, you have to have something to overcome. So for us to judge things and say, this is bad, this is wrong, that's just simply the mind. So if you let go of that and accept that everything that comes to you comes for your highest good, whatever that be, then you see, you lose your attachment to what's coming to you, and you stay more focused on that presence inside of you. And so it shifts your attention. And that part of you who judges, this is good and this is bad, this is for my upliftment, this other is worldly, this is God, this is not, that ceases to exist in the same way. So the question at that point becomes moot. Mm-hmm. Inherent within the question is duality. Mm-hmm. And ultimately we go beyond duality and say, it is all God, the world is God, as Swami Ram Dass named one of his books. The mind does not want to easily accept that. It says, but this is evil. How can that be God? This is good over here. It's a difficult thing. But by keeping the mind focused on God, the mind becomes purified. And when it's purified, it's able to take in that knowledge and sees the wisdom in it. One of the greatest ways to focus the mind on God is just to sing to God, chant God's name, focus in on the attributes of God. God is all joy, all love, all bliss, all wisdom. By doing our meditation and going deep inside of ourselves, by doing our Kriya Yoga, all these things draw us inwardly in order to experience that presence.
I've been going around in circles with the concept of surrender. We're here in the spiritual battle. We're not supposed to give up. And, you know, surrender seems like giving up or giving away something. What are you surrendering? And if it's an ego, how can I surrender the ego? You know, that kind of goes circular. So I think I'd like to have an example of what surrender.
Well, there are times that we have to fight things. If we're fighting a certain urge, say, we don't surrender to that urge. So we're not surrendering to the senses and the human ego. So what we're surrendering to is God within us. And we can even surrender the struggle of knowing what its surrender is about. Because that is the mind that is trying to grab hold of this knowledge. And ultimately, we have to go beyond the mind. So we can take that idea, I don't even know what surrender is, and surrender that. Let it go. One way of imagining that is just imagining the feet of God and just surrendering.